Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 25th of May 2022 and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop discussing news and current events in and around the UK construction industry. You know, we're going out on a limb here, Phil, because senior civil servant Sue Gray is expected to publish her report into the number 10 lockdown parties later on today. In fact, any minute now. And as everybody knows, you can't comment on anything until Sue Gray has published her report. So I don't know whether we should wrap it up now or carry on regardless. What do you reckon?
I'm going to carry on regardless.
Good. Yeah, I think we're safe. So, well, let's move on to our first topic then, which is the shock, surprising news that costs are increasing on a major infrastructure project.
Well, you're not talking about Crossrail, are you? Because now we've forgotten. About the delays and the cost overruns and all the problems that Crossrail has. And now we focus on the wonderful new piece of infrastructure that London's got. And, you know, once things are up and running, it's like, it doesn't matter about all the problems we had. It's now a great thing. And Her Majesty herself turned up. We, last time we were talking, we said, yay, Crossrail's opening. We talked all about it. And since then, she visited the site or one of the sites and pulled the curtain and opened a plaque. And yesterday, on the Tuesday, the 24th of May, first paying passengers. And there are masses of them. Every train spotter in the country was queuing up to get on the Crossrail trains.
I just don't understand that sort of mentality. I mean, it's still going to be fairly new tomorrow. So why don't you wait until all... You know, the thing that everybody hates about commuting in and out of London are the crowds. So why actually go and join the crowds when you know they're going to be crowds? Leave it until the novelty's worn off and then go and enjoy it under normal conditions. That's what I'd say.
When everyone else has been on it, you can't bore everyone with how up-to-date you are, having been one of the first people to go on the Elizabeth line. Yeah. Early mover advantage, it's called, to be the biggest pub bore. First mover advantage, beg your pardon.
Oh, right, okay.
Anyway, no, we're not talking about Elizabeth line, fabulous as it now is, that's up and running, and I haven't been on it, but I look forward to using it at some stage. We're talking about Hinkley Point C nuclear power station down sort of your neck of the woods in Somerset. And the news there coming out is that the French energy company Electricité de France, who are the majority owner of the project.
Nice pronunciation.
Have done a, it's probably a deep dive, I think that's what they call it, a study into what the costs are looking like and when they might finish it. It is now going to be 25 billion to 26 billion.
Yeah.
It was initially going to be 18 billion when they started construction. When did they start construction? December 2018, or maybe before they started construction. By September 2019, the cost estimate was at 21.5 to 22.5 billion. January 2022, the post-COVID investigation, it was 22 to 23 billion. And that wasn't a great jump. That September 2019 to January 22nd increase was only, you know, half a billion pounds up, only 500 million pounds up. And they've now gone, as you've quite corrected me, top end, 23 billion to 26 billion, which makes it basically 44% ahead of what it was just, what are we talking, 4 years ago. Which is a mighty cost increase. I don't think even Crossrail went up 44%, did it, over its life expectancy?
No, Crossrail was doing really nicely until they started to install the M&E. But that's another point. I mean, on a project that's valued at sort of 20 billion plus, then I suppose you'd say that. Well, four billion is still a big proportion of that, so it is a big jump. But I think when you get into that sort of magnitude of cost, none of it really is relatable. You can't really Yeah, 4 billion sounds an awful lot, but in the grand scheme of things...
It's 3 billion on top of what they were saying in January this year, in a few months.
Yeah.
It's 6 billion on top of what they were saying at the outset, on top of 18 billion.
Yeah.
So that's
a lot, isn't it?
I'd say 44%. That's getting on for 50%. And hey, it will be 50%. It'll be more than that. There's no way they're going to bring it in for 26 billion. Sorry, but they're not.
Not at this rate.
The review they've just done only looked at the main aspects of the project, the schedule and cost of electromechanical works and of the final testing have not been reviewed as part of that. And as we saw with Crossrail, that's a very tricky bit of it all. And
yeah
I think it's going to go up. I mean, there's hope that everything they've learned on the first reactor, because I think there are two reactors, aren't they, going in. And everything they've learnt on the first one, be able to bring that learning and do it quicker and more efficiently on the second one. But I think that's already been costed in from the outset that was going to happen. So, And the start date, we should mention, has also been put back. For the start of electricity generation for Unit 1 is now June 2025. It was originally... June 2027. It was originally sometime in 2025. Mm-hmm. So the start firing it up, the first reactor, has been pushed back 2 years. No mention the second one that I can see at the moment. But I don't want to do down the project. It's a hell of a project. It's a fantastic thing. You see the photos of the site. I haven't had the pleasure of going to the site, but it's a massive, massive undertaking.
Oh, it is. I mean, one of the worrying things, I think, from the very outset was the fact that I can't remember what this sort of reactor is called, but it's a new type, which I think was developed by the Chinese. Because, of course, this is EDF is developing this in joint venture, I believe, isn't it, with China General Nuclear Power Group.
It's roughly 66-34, kind of, two-thirds, one-third split.
Right, yes. Okay. But this type of reactor, I don't think they've actually built a successful one yet. There's one in France, which was extremely late and very
Flamanville, is that how you pronounce the place?
That's right, yeah.
And I think that's not started yet, has it? Is that live yet?
I don't know if it's started. I'm sure it's not finished.
Sorry, I meant started generating electricity, not started construction.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, I was going to say, yeah. No, I don't think it has. And there was another one in somewhere up in Scandinavia somewhere?
Finland rings a bell. But I don't know if that's the same tech. But.
Critics of the project have from the very outset said this is a really risky sort of technology that we're dealing with here, and they haven't got it right yet. So with that at the back of your mind, and as you say, the fact that all the M&E has yet to be costed, I think we ought to brace ourselves for huge cost increases and probably massive delays as well. It is a massive project. And as you say, it's a very impressive one. It's got that lovely big crane there. I mean, it's got several big cranes, but it's got the really big one. But I'm not sure that really lets off the hook if it's not going to be delivering, it's not going to be delivering cheap electricity. It's going to be delivering expensive electricity when it finally gets going, because they've struck this deal, haven't they, with the developers, that they'll get a minimum amount, which is much, much more than we're paying at the moment.
Much, much more than we were paying then. I think it's getting quite close to what we are paying at the moment, to be honest. And the good news for the taxpayer, the electricity bill payers, is that the deal is that price is fixed. And if they lose money on the project, they lose money on the project, and they're not going to charge the electricity bill payers anymore.
Yeah, that's the risk they're taking. I don't suppose anybody's surprised that prices are going up, because they always do on projects like this. It sort of comes with the territory, but that's a big increase. And
all those prices, we should add, are 2015 prices. So I don't know what 26 billion is, 2015, 26 billion pounds is in 2022, but it's got to be a couple of billion on top of that, hasn't it?
Yes, probably.
Anyway, I don't want to cast doom and gloom on glorious construction projects.
No, but you do want to get something off your chest, don't you, Phil? Because I'm thinking about the next topic on our agenda today.
Moving on, we're still in France with this one.
Yeah.
Well, hats off to EDF for bailing us out. Thank you. And actually, it involves sort of another French utilities company, or the legacy of it. This is all to do with the news this week that the Competition and Markets Authority, what used to be known as the Monopolies and Mergers Commission, the British regulatory body for acquisitions and mergers, has called for comments on the proposed acquisition of Equans by Bouygues. Mm-hmm. And obviously Equans and Bouygues are both big in the UK, got lots of operations, lots of employees, and the Competition and Markets Authority is running the rule over it, as it does of a merger acquisition of this size, to make sure that competition is not being screwed up.
I think we should point out, Phil, that I'm sure most of our listeners will know that Bouygues is, of course, a huge French contractor, and Equans is that's actually something to do with EDF, isn't it?
Not EDF. Equans is a new name that emerged last year when Engie, is how I pronounce it, no idea how the French might pronounce it, Engie hived off its technical services businesses into this new entity, or rebranded it, called Equans, and it's a big old company. I've got somewhere how much Equans is. 74,000 people in 17 countries, about a third of them in France, quarter of them in France. Annual turnover of more than 12 billion euros. In UK and Ireland, it turns over 2 billion euros and employs 13,500 people. And Equans, or Engie, that it used to be known as, Engie Technical Services, began life as part of Gaz de France. And it
sort of like the gas equivalent of Electricité de France,
of EDF France, yes. And those two merged together with Gaz de France and Electricité France were sort of sister companies, and then Gaz de France was merged with the water company Suez, and Suez changed its name to Engie. So Suez does that still exist in another form? I'm not sure. But Engie came out of the gas company and it merged with the water company, blah, 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 blah. And its focus in the UK is on energy and regeneration and type of projects.
Yeah.
A lot of public sector work. Anyway, they're big companies in the UK, but they're not that big. They're not top 20 contractors. And my first point on this is, I don't think the CMA should get too concerned about the coming together of, you know, companies who...
Two French companies.
Well, even if they're UK companies, one's 29 on our list of top 100 contractors and one's 42.
Okay.
I don't think that's really going to upset the market. That's point one. Point two is, these are two French companies. And yes, they've got activities over here. And I immediately kind of go, should the British... And I want to say British government, because the CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority, is independent of government. It's kind of like quasi-judicial. Mm-hmm. But it is a state operation. They are civil servants and state employees. It is an arm of government. Yeah. Should the British government be able to say to two French companies, no, you're not allowed to merge? And I had a bit of a head scratch. I thought, what do I know about this? And I thought, well, I don't know whether they should or they shouldn't, but they've got form on this at the CMA. It was only in March, I think it was, maybe February, when they scuppered a merger of two Finnish, by which I mean from Finland, crane companies.
Yeah.
Konecranes and Cargotec agreed a deal. Cargotec was going to buy Konecranes. Their core business, or the main thrust of the two companies, is dockside handling, container handling machinery. But Konecranes also has a big business in industrial lifting, in electric overhead travelling cranes, factory cranes, and other sectors. Mm. But it's mainly port and industrial. But mainly
Port. Passenger lifts. They make a lot of passenger lifts, don't they? Yeah.
Anyone who knows anything about dockside lifting knows that the Chinese manufacturers have completely gobbled up that market over the past 10, 20 years. Very dominant. Yeah. And the European companies, I mean, already because of Chinese competition, Demag's out of that business now. That's actually part of Konecranes. Noel, the Pine, some big German manufacturers have all gone. And basically, the only European manufacturers of dockside equipment left are in Scandinavia. And in order to shore up their defences against the Chinese competition, they said, let's keep Finland strong. Finland, let's come together and we can stay alive together. And the British government, in the form of CMA, says, nah, you can't. We're not going to let you. Every other bloody regulatory body around the place, the European Commission initially said, well, you might have to sell a bit. So Cargo Tech said, okay, we'll sell the forklift trucks and maybe a reach stacker business or something.
Yeah.
And so we'll do that. And everyone said, fine, yeah, fine, it makes sense. Even the Chinese authorities were okay with it. But the British authorities go, nah, that's not enough, not good enough. Our British ports will be, the competition in British ports for lifting machinery will be impaired. They'll end up paying more and getting worse kit. Yeah, they'll be getting worse kit. They'll have to buy Chinese kit now because the Finnish companies are going to go down the pan because their attempts save themselves have been thwarted by the British government. So, one, I think it was a mad decision by the CMA. But two, what would happen if Finland or France or China or some other country said, if Kia wanted to buy Tilbury Douglas, as was mooted in one of the newspapers not so long ago, if they said, well, I'm sorry, we're not going to allow those two British companies to join together because they've got a few employees or they sell some kit to us, we would be outraged as a nation, as companies.
Of course.
That our free market, free enterprise is being interfered with by not just our own nanny state, but other people's nanny states who should have no say.
No.
It annoys me. It annoys me. I think there's
I can tell.
There's
I can
something
tell.
Wrong.
I'm puzzled because I didn't know that the CMA would have that sort of cross-border influence. I mean, I would have thought that if they disapproved of it, for example, I mean, presumably their remit is within the, within these shores, that what happens in Finland or in France doesn't affect the UK. And so they might say, you're not allowed to operate in that way in this country. I didn't know that they could actually put a spanner in the whole works.
It does, actually. Because part of this deal is a what used to be a Loughborough company called Morris Material Handling, if you remember them. And then they were bought by Konecranes for its service business, basically. And then Konecranes bought Demag Industrial Cranes, the overhead cranes, not the Demag crawler cranes and mobile cranes. And so what is now Konecranes Demag Limited, or UK Limited, has got a, it turned over £72 million in the UK, this UK business, last year. And the threshold for the CMA to intervene under the rules of what can trigger its interests or right to intervene is the enterprise which is being acquired must turn over more than £70 million. And Konecranes Demag UK turned over £72 million. So it just squeaks in. But there's another big Barney going on. It was nothing to do with construction that is still sort of rumbling. And it got a lot of comment in the business press. JD Sports, the tracksuit and trainers retail, high street retailer, in April 2019, they agreed a deal to buy Foot Asylum, another retailer of training shoes and sports footwear. And that was all good and fine. Foot Asylum were basically going down to Swanee because no one was buying their trainers in shops anymore. They were going to try them on in shops and then going online to buy them cheaper from the ones they knew what they wanted. Mm-hmm. So Foot Asylum was basically rescued by JD Sports. Competition and Markets Authority said, no, that's too much competition. We've done research and we found out that people who go to JD Sports also go to Foot Asylum. And if one didn't exist, but they'd buy their shoes from the other. No, they wouldn't. They'd try them on in the other and still buy them online. Anyway, CMA said, a big appeal, but at the end of the day, CMA said, no, you've got to sell Foot Asylum. So Foot Asylum is actually still owned, even now, by JD Sports, but it's held as a standalone separate entity so that it can be sold, held for sale.
Oh, I see. So as a temporary measure.
I don't know whether anyone's put in a bid for Foot Asylum because it lost a lot of money last year. And I don't know if it owns its shops. I don't know if there's any good real estate there or if it's just got, big leases as overheads. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But JD Sports has not actually yet sold Foot Asylum. And it's still, I think the battle might still be going ongoing there. But it seems to me another bad decision by the Competitions and Markets Authority, not letting the market operate how the market needs to operate.
I think we've discussed the whole sort of monopoly and sort of competition situation before on the podcast, and it's a, you know, it sort of bubbles under all the time. You get these little cartels emerging and they're stamped on by the authorities, you know, in markets like cement classically, and I can't remember, but it's in building materials. They every now and then, rebar maybe, plasterboard, that sort of thing. And you think, well, yes, you know, you can't have all your, if you've only got, say, three cement producers operating in the UK, you can't have them all sitting around a table and agreeing prices and that kind
of
thing.
Absolutely agree.
Which is different. I know that's different from creating a monopoly situation. It's a cartel operation. And you think, well, yeah, you know, thank God for the CMA, because we need somebody looking at stuff like this, because that's clearly not a fair and equitable way of carrying on. And in the same way, you don't want somebody coming on just snapping up everything and, you know, cornering the market in something. So they should be looking at that as well. But I think when you start interfering in a global market, for something like that, I don't know, it just doesn't seem right that the British should be able to call the shots when everybody else is fine with it.
It's almost like we need to join some kind of, you know, pan-European organisation and form a view collectively. That can never happen, though.
No, that would never work. Still, I don't know. It's very strange. But, yeah, I wonder if the CMA are listening to you, Phil, and whether they'll... They will respond to your frustration, but I can tell you, it's palpable. I can tell that it's really getting to you.
Well, it was the Cranes one, which I think the Finland one. I just thought that, you know, this was so much in Finnish national interest that these two companies should come together.
Before we move away from that subject, you did in fact report on another CMA decision, which was relevant to construction, which was the proposed takeover of Euro Auctions by Ritchie Brothers, a big Canadian.
Yes.
Big Canadian firm. But that, I mean, do you feel differently about that one? Because it is a slightly different case,
isn't
it?
Well, no, I have less problem about the CMA sticking its oar in, because there was a British company that was being taken, that was a Canadian company, was moving in to take over a British company. And they are clearly the top two players. I think they've got sort of 90% of construction machinery physical auctions.
Yeah.
So I have less problem about CMA looking at that. But even then, I didn't have a problem with the idea, not that I buy construction machinery, but conceptually I didn't have a problem with two auction houses joining together and they're becoming a monopoly of auction houses, because I don't think auction houses sell that much equipment. I don't think they dominate the marketplace for used equipment that much, and they sell new equipment as well through auctions. They certainly don't dominate the new equipment marketplace. I may be wrong about that, but I thought most certainly in the olden days, used equipment used to be traded through, you know,
yes, on a small scale,
directly by dealers.
Yes,
and not only that, it's very hard for Ritchie Brothers or Euro Auctions to fix the price of a, you know, 10-year-old digger, because the price is whatever. It's an auction. It's whatever people stick their hands up.
Yeah.
Now, what they can fix is the rate that they charge, the 10%, 15%, whatever it is, the service, the cut that they take for doing for managing the deal. But if Ritchie Brothers or Euro Auctions took too big a cut, then no one would use them. I think it's a self-regulating market, it seems to me, because it's of the nature of the business.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, you might get the, because of course, when Ritchie Brothers are planning a big auction, they send out photographs of these enormous yards with, you know, serried ranks of equipment there, and there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of diggers and bulldozers and dumpers and all the rest of it. It looks like a really big deal. But as you say, that's very concentrated, and it's not a big proportion of the used equipment market. Because as you say, there are lots of dealers, small dealers around the country, all over the world, you know, sort of dealing in used equipment. So it's not taking a massive bite out of the market.
I think my problem is that the CMA is trying to stand up for the consumer at the absolute expense of the interests of tax-paying industries, wealth-creating industries. And while it is great that the consumer is defended, I don't think it should be at the expense of. I mean, I think there needs to be a balance, and it's about finding the balance between consumer interest and having anywhere to buy your training shoes, having anywhere to buy your machinery at auction, having any European manufacturer of cargo handling equipment left. And if you if you say, oh, if business wins, the consumer loses, it's not a zero-sum game. We can all win. And I think it's too heavily stilted towards consumer, which might be a controversial opinion.
Let's move on to another topic, which is very close to our hearts, a perennial topic, which is that of training and recruitment. We were contacted actually by somebody from the Department for Education who told us about this campaign that they've launched. I think they launched it last year at least, Further Education Teacher Recruitment Campaign, which is calling on those with substantial industry experience. And we're talking about not just construction, but other industries, but construction is one of the most prominent ones. Substantial industry experience to teach in further education and use their expertise and skills to train the next generation of workers. And the interesting thing about this is that they're looking for people with real life experience.
They're looking for people who can.
People with real life experience. And teaching and other academic qualifications are not a prerequisite, because they want these people to start. You know, we need to get training people now. So they don't want to recruit people for, you know, study as teachers. They want people who can already do it and transfer those skills directly. And so they've launched this campaign. They're encouraging actual people from industry to come along and teach people at further education colleges and so on, with full-time, part-time and flexible contracts available, allowing teachers to balance their hours alongside other professional or personal responsibilities. And in fact, I'm glad to say that we can actually speak to one of those people now, because we have a guest joining us. He is Dean Carpenter, a former construction worker and army instructor. He spent 32 years in the construction industry, also spent time with the Royal Engineers before deciding to turn his hand to further education teaching. And he now teaches level one construction skills and level two bricklaying at Andover College in Hampshire. Hi there, Dean. Glad to have you on the podcast. Tell us how you got into teaching.
Hi, David. I got into teaching in further education. I was ex-military, and as part of leaving the military, we have resettlement. So it's to help you get back into industry, into any new career that you want to get into if you want to. I've previously been a lecturer, a teacher in my trade in the military. I spent my last couple of years as a careers advisor in the army, so I was engaging with schools and colleges. And having left a school and a college, I haven't spoken to 10, 20, 300 assembly students. Teachers were telling me that I had a natural flair to speak to students and I could engage with them.
Okay.
And it's something I'd never even thought of before. So I looked into it. Part of the resettlement program from the military was what's called Further Forces program. So it was helping people to get from the military into teaching in further education or in schools. And I underwent that. How I did that was, there's a couple of ways. The way I did it was, I was actually employed by a college full time and learnt, qualified to become a teacher whilst on the job. And that's a 2-year, and that was run by Portsmouth University. So I was working full time in the college whilst undergoing the qualification itself.
How easy would it be for someone who's not got the infrastructure of the military with their programs for placing people back into civilian life or into civilian life, that if for someone who's just working as a construction worker, who's maybe not got a university degree, but have got a lot of experience in their trade or trades, how easy that them for them to do what you did? How would they go about getting into teaching?
It's exactly the same way. I just had the assistance of the military, but with the assistance from the college. If you go into teaching further education, it'll give you all the information there, but you can do it part-time, you can do it full-time. So if you're a little bit wary of maybe the financial situation, you can't afford to do it full-time, you still want to do 3 days on the job, and then you can do it 2 days in college, because obviously while you're getting the qualification need to be assessed and people need to come in and watch you teach and make sure that you can teach. You have mentors, mentees, there's people within the college that assist you while you're doing it. So you're learning on the job.
Right.
My biggest thing was with, because I was 50-year-old when I left the military, and I thought, right, and I went to the teaching further education, and I went to an interview and I said, well, I'm a little bit worried that I'm a 50-year-old with no teaching qualifications. And they said the biggest thing I had that I didn't realise was life experience and skill. And if, how that is delivered to the student, you can either do it or you're taught how to do it.
In a way, you were lucky, weren't you? Because you had you'd had that experience in the army of being an instructor, and talking to people about careers. So in a way, you sort of, that eased you into it, didn't it? It wasn't like a real culture shock.
It wasn't a culture shock also because I coach football, I teach karate, I'd worked with youth clubs.
Okay.
So I'd worked with teenagers and youngsters as well previously. So that aided me massively in engaging with the younger generation. Obviously, you come into teaching further education and we have lesson plans, schema works, you embed equality and diversity and you learn all the bigger part of it. And then you think, you start hearing all these words like equality and diversity and stretch and challenge. And it's like, what? And when you talk to somebody and you realise you do that every day, you don't realise what you're doing. It's something that you do naturally in your job. You engage with apprentices on site, you engage with customers and clients, and it's the way you talk to these people and explain things. And it's, I mean, you've got to bring it down to the student's level. And what really appealed to me, I thought was the biggest effect was if we've all worked on sites, we've worked with apprentices, you'd maybe engaging with 2-3 apprentices or maybe even one. Here in a college, in the colleges that I've been working with, straight away I'm engaging with between 12 and 22 students. Your audience straight away is massive. And it's like, wow, I mean, you're making a change to not just maybe 1-2 individuals on site. You've got all these students for the 10 hours, the 15 hours. You've got their full attention, not all the time, admittedly, but you've got their attention. And it's like, wow, I mean, all these people in a wonder, it's great.
Do you have the same resources in the classroom that you would have if you're training an apprentice on site? Everything is there because you've got the materials for the job that you're actually on site. In the classroom, do you have to make do or do you have everything you need?
No, everything you need. The awarding body, so for example, we have City and Girls of the awarding body. They come out and they say, right, they design a programme, so it could be a level one, level two, it could be a technical, it could be anything. And they plan the resources around that skill set. What do you need to be able to deliver that qualification? You need these materials, you need those tools. So therefore, the budget that the college gets incorporates you, so me as an individual, in before the term starts in August, what am I going to need for the year? I need another 1,000 bricks, I need some more lime mortar, I need some 4x2 for doing form work, I need whatever, I put it in, boom, it's all delivered.
So the course is it's a curriculum that's defined by City and Guilds or whoever, it's not just you coming into class and thinking, right, I mean, let's do scaffolding today or let's do form work today. There's a set stuff that you have to teach them, I guess.
Yeah, so it's all encompassing. So I'll give you an example. I teach a level one diploma in construction skills. So we do 5 elements of brickwork and we also then take them outside because they have to get so many credits to get the qualification. So there's 37 credits. Each credit's worth between 3 and 4. So what can I put into this? So this is where they've come to me and said, right, you're the bricklayer. We want to have this qualification. There's a massive list from City and Guilds because it's a diploma in construction skills. There's everything on there. There's plastering, there's tiling, there's painting, wallpaper and everything. I wanted to base this around brickwork because I then want them to go on to a level 2 technical certificate that's just in brickwork. So I take from that list, I took the 5 elements of brickwork. And then I also added into that, I take them outside, I do paving slabs, block paving, gravel paths and concreting. So you take out of there, you know what I mean, this is what we want to deliver, this is what the students need, this is what I feel industry needs. Okay, I'll take them all from there. What's it say I need to do there? Right, so for half brick walling, they need to do it so big. It needs to be 10 bricks long by 8 courses high. Okay, then I'll start them off on 4 bricks long, then build up to 6, and then take it from there. So to show progression, you can't go straight in, right, they've got to be able to build a 10 brick wall, right, let's go straight to a 10 brick wall. Let's start them off. Some people have a natural flair for this, some people don't. So if somebody builds a 4 brick wall and then a 6 brick wall and I see they've got it, right, make straight into the 10 brick wall so we can work at their ability and their speed. Some people it takes a little bit longer. So this is where the planning that you're able to teach and the flexibility we have on site. It's raining, all right, we're not going to lay bricks in the rain. What we're going to do, as I explained to the students, you might start off as a bricklayer or a carpenter or whatever, we all end up general builders. We can all throw our hands to something. We go and give the friends a lift. You won't always be laying bricks. What if it's raining? Let's go back inside and let's do something else.
Yeah. You've clearly got a flair for teaching, and you're obviously very comfortable in that environment. The whole purpose of this campaign that the Department for Education is keen to promote is that they want people with skills to come and show people how to use those skills. Not everybody is going to be as comfortable in the teaching environment as you are. And a lot of people, I mean, I've had teachers who really know their subject, but cannot put it across. They cannot convey that information. Supposing, you know, we've got a massive shortage of tilers or roofers, and we recruit loads of tilers and roofers in order to get them to convey their knowledge. If they don't have that ability to teach, to transfer their knowledge, is there support? I mean,
massive. Yeah.
Will they be able to do the job with support from the college or from the authority?
Massively. So I'll give an example. I did it through, it was the Gatsby Charitable Foundation, funded it on behalf of the military, run by Portsmouth University. You've not only got, you're in a cohort of students. They won't be just you doing the qualification. There'll be a group of you. So that's a great way. You're in with like-minded people. You're learning to do the job. You have a mentor. So somebody, mine was David Madder, that's a doctorate in education. That, you know what I mean? If he didn't, he's probably forgotten more than I'll ever learn. And he's there. So he's there to teach with. You've got your fellow cohort students. I had somebody from Brighton University that I could email, text at the drop of a hat. I don't understand this. How would you benefit from that? You go to other colleges, you go to the college within yourself, and you're asked to go along and actually assess another fellow lecturer giving a lesson with the format that you use. So go in, what did you think of his lesson? So it's like what we call peer feedback. Mm. So that's great. What did you think? Well, I thought this was good. I thought this was bad. So the person that you're watching might not realise. And sometimes it takes a fresh set of eyes. You have people from the college come and say assess, look at you and say, right, yeah, very good, Dean, but this could have been a little bit better. Maybe don't mention this. Maybe you could have thought about that. I mean, or what would you do in this situation? And get you to think about it. And if it doesn't come to you, then they're there. And you've got the people that you work with. So I work in a department here with carpenters, plumbers, electricians. I also work in the same office as motor vehicle, but we don't like to talk about them. So you've got those people that have come from industry that to assist you as well. So there's a whole raft of people. You are never on your own. You might be on your own in that classroom for a period of time with those students, but if you need help, then it's there. And sometimes the level of student that you've got might come with what we call an LSA, a learning support assistant. That student might need assistance in the classroom. So that support is there for that student as well. So as much as we're taught to tailor the lesson for the top and the bottom, or the different scale of ratio, you know what I mean, then there's always somebody in there to help you.
Is there an upper age limit for people with experience to go into teaching, into further education teaching?
No upper age limit at all. No, it's a willingness to deliver it and your skill. Like I say, I was 50. Then they said to me, you know what I mean, I said to them a question, I could have stayed in the army till I was 55 and then come out and look for a job. But I was thinking, 55, is that a bit late in the day? And they said, we'd have taken you at 55. It's not a problem. You come in it.
You weren't tempted to come out of the army and start laying bricks again. I mean, I know you obviously probably do lay bricks on a fairly regular basis, but I mean, was that your original plan that when you left the army you'd work full time as a bricklayer again?
Oh yes, because I was self employed for 6 years before I joined the military.
Right,
I did what's called a 26-week course with Taylor Wimpers up in Manchester in Urmston. Came off that qualification, worked for a company. They said, we're not taking your cards in. You'll have to go self-employed. Okay, not a problem. And ended up moving through a few companies and travelling all around the country and doing it. And it's only because, and I explained to my students, now is the time. The industry's massive and crying out for people at the moment. We know it goes through peaks and troughs.
Yeah.
It was going through a trough in the early 90s, which is why I just happened to drive past the Army Careers Office one day on the way to a job and stuck my head in and, we got in the Army for a bricklayer. And there I was in there for 26 and a half years. So it was a case of, right, well, I'll do this. And the plan was to do it initially for 4 years, minimum return. It's filling a gap till the industry picks back up again, come back out, jump on the tools.
Wow.
You can't always plan what's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, throughout the military, I've always still kept my hand in. I've got a job on this weekend.
Well, you'd say that you're in your early 50s. I can't remember what the average age of a skilled construction worker is in the UK now, but I don't think you're far off that. I think that probably, we've got an aging workforce here. So, you know, a lot of people out on site are your contemporaries, aren't they, even now? But do you feel that you're making more of a contribution to the industry by transferring your skill as a teacher to a younger generation than you would be out working on site now?
Yes, definitely. Like I mentioned previously, you could be given an apprentice to work with. So that's one person, maybe two people.
Yeah.
But now you've got 20 between 12 or 30, and 22 students in front of me. And not all of them will make it. But I mean, if we talk about ratios, then what's the net result of 22 students? So I currently have 28 students on the level one. The real estate depicts that I can only take 14 students onto my level two technical certificate. So I tell the students, you need to prove to me, it's basically Top Gun.
Yes.
To get onto the level two, you need to be, not dressing like Tom Cruise, but proving to me that you're the best of the best. And that's the only way you're going to get into the top two. But also informing this, not everyone is going to get onto the level two, but they've passed a level one. They've got a qualification. And I say to them, you have got a level one qualification, City and Guilds diploma in construction in bricklaying. That's something you can take to the industry now, to an employer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I speak to them honestly. I said, right, I'm going to speak to you like you're going to be spoken to on site, which doesn't always impress the college, but I'm getting, they're now classed as young adults. So I said, I'm going to speak to you like an adult. Right, you're going to meet some colourful characters on site. You've met your first one. I'm getting you ready for the people that you're going to meet out there. You've got a qualification, you're going to go on site. Yes, they're not going to throw you straight onto brickwork. You could be labouring for a bit. That's why the first week that I have them in college, it just so happens that it matches in with my manual handling part of the qualification, that I get them humping and dumping all week and doing some and labouring and mixing and carrying bricks and everything. And it's just that first week is a bit of an eye-opener for them. Say, you've got a qualification, you go on site, this is what you could start off. He'll throw you a bit of brickwork, he'll see what your skill level is, and it just rises from there.
And that's the voice of experience, isn't it? Which presumably a professional teacher wouldn't necessarily be able to have. I mean,
if we're talking about somebody that's gone from school, that's done A-levels, that's gone to university to do teaching, they're great for what I feel is the academic subjects, your maths, your English, your sciences and all this. For your vocational courses, for your carpentry, for your electricians, for your bricklayers, you need that practical. I feel that you need that experience more than you need any form of qualification in teaching. I come into this, I've got all I had is functional skills, level two in maths and English. That's all you require. I mean, you don't need a degree to come into teaching.
No.
I've got what's called a certificate in education, which is a level five. I could have gone on to do level seven. And now if I do a level five, I can only teach 16 and above. But if you do level seven, then I can go into junior schools. It's my preference that I don't want them that young. I want them now ready to get them, you know what I mean? With an attitude, but hopefully with the right attitude and a work ethic.
Yeah.
Out of uniform, in a more relaxed atmosphere, so that they can come straight from me onto site. I don't want to go into school and they come straight from me and in 3-4 years' time, then wherever. Hit them where they can be most effective.
And how long have you been teaching now?
I've been teaching 4 years now. So I left the army 2018, It took me 2 years to qualify.
Yeah. It sounds to me as if you found your vocation. You know, like somebody who is really passionate about what they do.
I'm passionate about construction. I love it. It's something I've done all my life. I didn't know when I left school that I was going to go into construction. My dad was a plumber. He likes to say he's got letters after his name, PhD, but that stands for plumbing, heating and drains. I'd worked with him, and it was a case of I didn't know what I wanted to do. This course came along. I'm a big believer in fate as well. So the course came along with Taylor Wimpey, 26 weeks. I go and do that and didn't realise until I was doing it, look at this. I've built that. There's a visual thing there that you can see that is going to be there forever. Yeah. Well, he wasn't in training because you use lime mortar and you have to take it down once you finish, same as you do at college. But they get a photograph of it once you've finished, so it'll be forever on the phone.
Sure.
It just won't be forever in the workshop. Sure.
David, any final question? I think we've just about covered it.
We've covered a lot of ground very quickly. So, no, I don't think I've got any more questions. Is there anything else you wanted to say, Dean?
A lot of people say, what's the biggest challenge? I mean, or yeah. What's the best thing and what's the worst thing? And you look, and I'll answer that honestly. It's the students are the best thing and the worst thing.
And the worst thing.
Have. Yeah, no, you'll get those challenges. We've come across yeah. them. I mean, I don't know, we've had children, or you've had the challenges with your own children. And they come into the college, some of them quite openly don't really want to be there, but they couldn't find a job, so they're going to come into college. So there's a challenge. But and I have been successful, and you see that student that I'm only coming here because I've got nothing better to do. And then they realise they can do it, and hopefully we have a good time do it. I like to involve a lot of humour in my lessons because that's how I remember things. If it's funny, I'll remember it.
Sure.
If you have to write it down and research it and do dissertations on it, then no. So those students come in. So there's, you know what I mean, what's the worst thing? That initial student walking in through the door like that. But then you see them grow and turn around. But you get the student that comes in and I want to be a bricklayer. That's all I want to do. All I've ever wanted to be was a bricklayer. Fantastic. And they come in, and you can engage with them. Not a problem. So you tend to find that those that want to get on, and you know what I mean, they're not a challenge. I can put them in. I put them in a bit of the workshop. Say, right, build me that. Right, go, yeah, boom, 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 boom. Whereas some students, you've got to keep going back to. Yeah, do us a favour, mate. Put your phone away. Yeah, you know what I mean, remember, you could be getting paid per brick on site. You know what I mean, or you could be getting paid by the meter. Gents, you've not even earned enough to pay for a sandwich for lunch yet. And putting things in like that. So when you say what's the best thing and the worst thing, that's the students.
The students.
You get both ends of the scale.
Dean, thanks ever so much for coming on and talking to us about that. It does sound like you're really doing a job you enjoy and you know, doing your best to transfer that enthusiasm to a younger generation.
I suppose the one final question we should ask is, what's the website? Where do people go if they're interested part-time teaching on the side or full-time?
Yeah, if you go to teach, just into Google, teaching further education, and that'll directly...
Teaching further education.
Yeah, teaching further education. Yeah, teaching FE, further education, whatever you want to type, and that'll give you the relevant links to there.
Right, excellent.
Thank you very much.
No problems.
Well, I wish I had a useful skill to teach people, David, but I'm not sure that I do.
Yeah, me too. It must be nice. He clearly loves his job, and it's always great to see somebody so enthusiastic about something, especially when it's his second or third career, really. That's great, you know, and I can see why the government is keen to recruit people like Dean, because he's an inspirational teacher, I guess.
Right, we're just about done for the day. Anything else we should talk about briefly?
Well, I've just had a notification on my news feed that Sue Gray has indeed just published her report. So I'm going to go off and read it now.
I don't know what she said,
but it just clicked up on my phone.
Right, well, I'm going to rush off and do that too then.
Give us something else to talk about.
But before I do, I just want to say thank you to our regular listeners, and I'd especially like to thank you who are listening for the first time today and have got this far. Hopefully you will listen again next time. We'll be back, David and I, in a couple of weeks' time, I think, with Reconstruction. But for now, from both of us, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.